This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We all want stuff. We're Americans. We want what we want when we want it. Consumer confidence, consumer spending, consumer sentiment, consumer debt. Our money makes the economy go round. But how long can that keep going on? Marketplace brings you a special podcast of our series, Consumed, where we try to figure out if we can actually afford all of this in the long run.
We want more. We want more.
Here's how to order.
Now, how much would you pay?
But you can see it's worth it.
Call now, because you're worth it, worth it, worth it.
Think about what happens on any given day in the consumer economy. Somebody out and about just running some errands.
So here's the deal. I need a new pair of running shoes. Am I supposed to just find a salesman?
You know what's funny? No price tags on any of these. Am I shallow if I shop for shoes based on how they look? Probably.
Total comes out to $119.89.
There you go. $119.89 for a pair of shoes.
And the guy said to me, you know, what a lot of people do is they buy two pair of shoes.
I came in here for a propane tank, a couple of sets of light bulbs, and a soap dish for the shower in the kids' room. And here I am standing in the grill section looking at grills, which amuses me because I have a grill. Does anybody ever walk in here and go, there are just too many choices?
No.
Come on, really?
Really?
$21.99 on my hair. That's what I'm spending, you know, to make my hair look pretty, right? Oh, you know what's happening? I'm getting more gray in the back of my hair, man. That's
not my fault, okay?
No, it's not your fault. No. My Saturday in the consumer economy? Made. New propane tank, sneakers, and a haircut. What else do you need? Thank you for visiting.
Let me give you that receipt.
Of course.
One of my days in the consumer economy, obviously, but just one of them. Nothing special, really. The same thing lots of us do all the time. A couple of stores, a much-needed haircut. But you multiply that by 300 million people, and you start getting why a pretty fair chunk of our economy is based on just the things we buy. Throughout my day, I ran into people in debt, people working in part-time jobs, people saving up for big life events, the whole shebang. So is it all worth it? The good news is I didn't have to buy anything when I went to register my daughter for soccer last weekend before the haircuts and the hardware.
All right,
store.
Whoa, soccer?
What?
I'm sorry, I got to stop you there.
Scott, Kyle. You know we're doing a show, right? You know that?
Well, yeah, and I'm in the show. We're doing
Scott,
this.
Scott Tong from the Sustainability Desk.
We're doing this series called Consumed
yes,
this
we
week,
are.
But I have to tell you, the Tongs are all in on soccer.
Okay.
I mean, minus the minivan. I mean, we're the
picture. I got
the
minivan, dude. I got the minivan.
Well, I got three kids playing and two in this peculiar subculture known as travel soccer.
Oh, yeah.
So if you add up all the fees here and the cleats and the gas mm-hmm. for the carpool, I mean, we're talking about a car payment just about.
Yeah, we are. But why, right? Why are we doing this? What are we doing?
We want mobility, right? We want your kids and my kids to chase a couple rare spots in college someday.
Yeah.
And so to get there, if you want to play high school sports, yeah. you have to pay. If you want to play the oboe and to be good at it, you have to pay.
Yeah.
Right? If you want a good suit to interview in, you have to pay or to live in the right school district. So we're all kind of part of this.
It's the long game, right? That's what we're playing.
Well, your family, mine, everyone right. in between. So where I went to tell the story was a very middle-class suburb of Washington called Charles County, Maryland.
Yeah.
Very diverse. Houses there sell for about $300,000. And there, Kai, I found the Jackson family. Spent a few days keeping up with them, or trying to. Because at 2 o'clock in the afternoon there, the madness starts.
18-year-old Jada flies in and out first.
I want to call Coach Brand in the car.
A track and student government star, she's off to her personal trainer.
Mom?
Yeah.
Hey, Mom.
Next in, basketball stud Cameron, age 12. Shoe size 11.
Hey, Mom.
What are you doing?
And then 6th grader Connor checks in by iPhone video from his bedroom. The boys sprint through clarinet practice, homework, tacos for dinner.
Come on, get your stuff, let's go!
Then Mom Nikki gets him out the door. Try to keep up here. Cameron has a basketball game. It's his county team, not his select travel team. And he plays baseball, and separately, all-star baseball, plus football workouts on Sundays.
Take over, do what you gotta do, what did I tell you? Take over.
Hands up, Brett. Come on.
Connor plays three sports, too, plus all-county orchestra. Tired yet? Or hear yourself in this? Welcome to the new parenting arms race. like the Cold War arms race, each side or each family invests in an arsenal. Except it's not ICBMs. It's trophies, accolades, newspaper clippings. It's the currency of college and job resumes. Once, only the wealthy ran this race. Now families like the Jacksons have their own lane, too. So, what's the cost? There are several ways to look at this. First of all, sleep.
My alarm is set for 4:15. Get up, shower up.
That's Dad Lewis Jackson behind the wheel. He's a facilities supervisor, and he works early so he can get home and ferry around his overscheduled kids. Jackson never went to college.
Coming up, I wanted to be a chef, but I had to come out of high school and help pay bills for my mother.
Jackson climbed the middle class ladder himself, graduated to a life in Charles County, and he wants his kids to stay there. Growing up, he was mugged, carjacked, shot at.
No food in the house. Waking up in the middle of the night, no electricity. I will never go back to any of that. I'm going to make sure that they have every opportunity that I did.
Opportunities cost money. Camps, tutors, living in a good school district. Take the Jacksons and baseball. This is the next evening.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
The price tag per season here is easily $1,000 per kid. All three children see the personal trainer at $20 a pop. 5 iPhones run $300 a month. And there's the travel team costs.
From July until mid-August, we will probably have stayed in 4 or 5 hotels and traveled over 2,000 miles.
And then there's Connor's baseball bat. $179. Are you kidding me? His dad said that too, till he saw it turn on a fastball.
It's a big difference from a $40, $50 bat. It's a big difference, man. And that's where you say you gotta pay to play.
Pay to play is the theme of this arms race, from the baseball bat to the clarinet. Sound nuts? Well, it may actually be an economically rational choice. Paul Tough, the author of How Children Succeed, explains.
There's evidence that the more selective college you go to, the more likely you are to earn a lot of money when you get out of that college. And getting into a selective college means doing well on tests and on grades and on extracurricular activities, and a lot of those do come with a price tag.
But here's his concern. These learning opportunities, private school tutors, buying into a good school district, travel sports, they're only available to the better off.
There is this bigger social question of what it means when something like education becomes a consumer good rather than a public good.
And there's this issue. If every family spends to boost their kids' future, every single kid gets a boost. No one moves up in the order. They've just spent more.
We can't be like the rich if you're not rich.
That's Michelle Singletary. She writes the Color of Money personal finance column for the Washington Post, and she's raising her own family in the county next door to the Jacksons. But now she is talking to me as I make the case for spending $1,500 on travel soccer for my second grader. It gets her going.
So if you don't have any credit card debt and you don't have any other consumer debt and you're saving at a comfortable rate for your retirement, both of you, and you're saving at a comfortable rate for your children's college education, all of them. If you can't answer yes to all of those questions, you cannot afford that $1,500 check.
Ooh, silence.
And she says, think through where the arms race goes and the people it's produced, say on Wall Street. Get ready for a provocative argument.
Those people pushing those mortgages to people who couldn't afford it, they weren't thinking about the people who were signing on the other side of that table. How could you in good conscience have people sign those kind of mortgages? Who raised that kind of person? It's the people who are pushing and pushing their kids and pushing their kids to succeed. That's who raised that kind of person.
Hey, get a good look before you shoot, always.
So I put all this to the Jacksons. Is it worth it? As they see it, it's already paid off. Their daughter Jada got a full academic ride to a nearby college based on her grades and her student government and track and field record.
Academics. It's okay, but athletic-wise, if you have that wow factor, you will reap all the benefits that even a 4.1 or 4.2 student would not be able to get.
The hope, the gamble, is that the younger kids get scholarships too. If not, there will be tough choices.
If I have to get another job, work 2 jobs to make sure that they're able to go to college and be afforded that opportunity, I will do that. And one thing I will tell you, this is sort of personal, I don't mind applying for loans.
As for other trade-offs, their insane schedule has cost her and her husband some relationships with old friends.
They've fallen off. I'm not saying that they're no longer friends, but I guess it's been a bad taste in their mouth about how we are so, they seem to think that we are fanatics about it, but it's just that we put our children first.
We're paying this now, you know, baseball bats, football equipment, fees, gas, is so that they can have an opportunity to be noticed and recognized by these schools out here to get them what they want and where they want to be in life.
So, Kai, that's basically Lewis Jackson's answer to whether we can afford this consumer arms race.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds crazy, but for his family, he says they can't afford not to.
Scott Tong, out of Charles County, Maryland, for us. Scott, thanks a bunch.
All right, you're welcome.
All that suburban competition probably couldn't have been anticipated by Adam Smith, the guy who wrote The Wealth of Nations more than 200 years ago. Smith back then tried to explain how the economy works and how it grows, and he spent a lot of time talking and writing about how we consume and how we should consume in a capitalist economy. Joining me now is the political satirist P.J. O'Rourke, who's written a book about Adam Smith called On the Wealth of Nations. P.J., thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, I quote you quoting Adam Smith all the time. You want to know what I quote?
Tell me.
All right. It's this great line. It's about halfway through the actual Adam Smith book and right at the front of yours. It says, consumption is the sole end and purpose of all production. Boom. Done.
Yeah, because otherwise, what's it there for? Right? I mean, if you're making paper cups, you know, and you got 10 billion paper cups and nobody wants to drink out of paper cups anymore, what are you in business for? But, you know, that was an idea that was not current when Adam Smith was thinking about all this. There was this idea that the purpose of production was to build up treasure or something. The idea that it was for the sake of consumers, it just hadn't occurred to the human brain before Adam Smith.
And yet it is clear that in a way he was wrong, right? Because we can't just keep on consuming. I mean, you look around today and it's just not tenable. It's not sustainable.
Well, what he meant by consumption and what we mean by consumption are two different things. By consumption, he really meant that the purpose of all production is to make something that's useful. He was not thinking about buying a whole mess of T-shirts from a shady factory in Bangladesh. You know, he was not thinking about consumer electronics. The word had a different nuance at the time.
The question, though, PJ, is, you know, as Adam Smith comes up with this theory, and it's all about self-interest and division of labor and freedom to trade, which is great in 1776 England, but you make that 2013 America, and the question is, how long can it keep going like this?
Well, see, I wouldn't call Smith what Smith did a theory. I would call it an analysis. Well,
okay.
If you talk to most businessmen, they won't really acknowledge. I mean, they'll say that what they do is for the public good, but you know in their heart they're just greedy. You know, I mean, what they're doing, they're just doing this for profit. And consumers are just consuming for, you know, the sake of their own greed. But, you know, Smith, who pointed out that the system actually produces some very good things. And we wouldn't have any of those good things if we didn't have this system of pursuit of self-interest.
Yes, but here's the thing. This is all really well and good in theory, but as we sit here in the early 21st century, you have consumers piling on debt until they can't see anymore. You have companies doing what they will to maximize their profit at the expense of those consumers. How far are we from this ideal that Adam Smith set up?
Ah, but it's not an ideal.
Sure it is.
So No, it really isn't. What Adam Smith was trying to do was explain how economic progress happens.
Yeah.
The mechanics of economic progress were just completely ununderstood at the time that he wrote The Wealth of Nations. Adam Smith's huge failure was the fact that he did not foresee the Industrial Revolution. But then when you come to the follies of capitalism, he knew exactly about the business of loading on debt. He was opposed to idiocy. He was also opposed
That's a good line.
To,
I like that.
You know, as even the smartest among us has, he had his blind spots. So I wouldn't say that anything Adam Smith had to say has been superseded. But, of course, a whole lot of situations have arisen that Adam Smith could not very well foresee all those years ago, and we have to come up with answers for those.
It's on us now. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it is.
The book by P.J. O'Rourke about a book that Adam Smith wrote is called On the Wealth of Nations. P.J., thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
That little mention that PJ slipped in about businesses being greedy, a lot of them have taken the route of focusing on short-term gains instead of the big long-term picture. But some bigwigs are saying that's not the way. We can do better. Example one, Unilever, the third largest consumer goods company in the world. It makes food, soap, personal care products. It owns Ben & Jerry's and is the world's largest producer of ice cream, in fact. And it spends almost the most in the world on ads. But its CEO, Paul Pullman, criticizes what he calls mindless consumption. He skips earnings reports and proposes something instead called mindful consumption. So, how does all that work in a consumer economy? I called him up and I asked him that question. Mr. Pullman, good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
One of the things that intrigued me about the way you're changing things is not sustainability on its face, but is much more business oriented. This idea you have that you're not going to issue quarterly guidance, that you're not going to give updates on where you think the company is going to go in the short term. Why do you do that?
Well, I think the first thing we had to do is it is indeed a business model. We actually started from the assumption that we can accelerate our business. But we've also said we need to do that in a way that is a little bit more responsible. So we abolished the quarterly reporting. That's only, frankly, 90 days minus the weekends is 76 days. That's not very much, if you think about it. We stopped giving guidance and we changed our compensation system accordingly. And that has resulted, at least for a company like ours, in a change in behavior and sent the right signals of what we were trying to achieve. I saw a recent survey in the U.S. that 75% of the CEOs were willing to postpone the right decisions if it would affect their quarterly reporting.
Wow.
And that cannot be healthy for the long term for their business.
What do you make and I'm going to generalize here, but what do you make of the attitude that there seems to be on the part of a lot of companies that what they need to do is maximize shareholder value?
Well, I don't think the debate always tries to polarize that you cannot do one versus the other. There is absolutely no reason why you cannot maximize shareholder value whilst at the same time also taking care of the other stakeholders. In fact, we would submit at Unilever that these two go hand in hand. We've seen our share price more than double over the last 4 years and our growth accelerate. So if you explain it well, why you do these things, more and more shareholders are behind that.
Well, tell me about the conversations you have then with your peers. And granted, Unilever's an enormous company, so you don't have a whole lot of peers. But when you get together with the CEO of Procter & Gamble and Nestle, what do you guys talk about when you think about how to make your business doable for the long term?
Well, obviously, we don't get together that often, and there are fairly strict competitive guidelines, so I want to stress that. But it is also clear that there are some areas where it's in the best interest for the total industry, obviously, to work together. For example, we are one of the bigger ice cream sellers with brands like Ben & Jerry's or Magnum. For us, it's very important that we move to natural refrigerants in our ice cream cabinets. Coalitions with Coke, with Pepsi, with Nestle and ourselves are converting this market now to natural refrigerants at a global level. That needs a tipping point. No individual company can do that alone.
Do you think capitalism's working the way we're doing it right now?
I think it's still the best form of running economies. That's proven over and over if you travel the world. And what we've created here is an enormous force to lift people out of poverty, but at the same time, we've not figured out how to do that without incurring these enormous levels of government or private debt, overconsumption, and frankly, leaving too many people behind. Even today, you cannot say that the system properly works if there are over a billion people going to bed hungry, if 2.5 billion people don't have access to basic hygiene or sanitation. And businesses also have to take co-responsibility in trying to find solutions.
Paul Pullman. He's the CEO of Unilever. Mr. Pullman, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai. I appreciate it.
One way companies can increase their profits, a bit more old-fashioned in a way, is by simply selling more stuff. And sometimes it's easier to try to sell more to existing customers than to drum up new business. Enter the upsell. On that Saturday full of errands I mentioned up at the beginning, one of my stops was a nearby hardware store. All I needed was a propane tank for the grill, light bulbs, and a soap dish. But I found myself drawn to the grill section, which is funny because I already have a grill. It works fine. But, man, those big expensive ones are pretty.
So tell me the difference between that $850 propane grill and that $1,500 propane grill. What's the difference?
A couple of burners.
A couple of burners
is pretty much it.
But your steak tastes the same.
It does.
It's nice looking for $300.
Absolutely.
What, now, do you have one of these?
This is my next upgrade. And the reason for that is because my wife prefers the propane.
Can I just tell you how funny it is that you're talking about a grill upgrade?
I know, right?
Don't you think?
It's considered an upgrade because it's adding on stuff that you don't already have.
I get it. Is that the upsell right there?
Exactly.
That's it right there, ladies and gentlemen. The art of the upsell, where companies try to sell you something more, something pricier. Does this sound familiar?
Would you like fries with that?
Companies trying to sell you something extra like fries or maybe something pricier.
And how about a new silk tie to go with that gorgeous shirt?
I could offer you more legroom and coach. It's only $49 more.
Have you considered a plastic cover for your new smartphone? I just got these in super cute polka dot cases today. They're adorable.
Amazing offers, right? So the company doing the offering can grow and keep on growing. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner is here to explain how business is doing this kind of business, in fact, us. Sarah, this is your basic upsell, right?
Right. It's the upsell. Yeah. I call it the perpetual upsell because it seems like nowadays we always have this experience of being sold either something more or something pricier. And sometimes it happens and you don't even know it's happening. It seems to be a part of almost every consumer transaction we have.
In fact, actually, with me, it happened in Starbucks the other day. I was buying a cup of coffee, $2.25. The guy tried to sell me a pound of special blend beans. And I'm like, yeah, no.
But you know what? A lot of people take it because these companies do it because it works. The market research shows that. And companies are getting even more sophisticated at it because they have all this data about us and our tastes from online shopping.
So it's easier, right? It's targeted.
It's easier.
Wow.
But the point, Kai, is it's not just easier. It's that they have to do it now. It's a requirement of a mature consumer economy. And that's according to Sunil Gupta. He's head of marketing at Harvard Business School. And he explains it this way.
Every company is expected to grow. And at some level, that sounds ridiculous because no company can grow forever. Otherwise, it'll take over the world. But in some ways, that is the expectation from Wall Street and the shareholders, which makes it very, very hard for companies to survive. So as a result, a company would say, look, I already have you as a customer, and it's easier to sell more things to you than to go and look for a new customer.
Easier, but Kai, cheaper too. It's just now woven into the fabric of our consumer economy.
Here's the thing, though. We're all reasonably responsible, mature adult American consumers. We can always just say, thank you, right? Yeah,
we could, just like, you know, you stand in line at the movies and just say no to the jumbo popcorn.
I do, every time.
But where this gets problematic or maybe a little uncomfortable, here's a story I heard from a woman named Maura Kelly.
Okay.
She lives in St. Louis. She's a lawyer. She's 33 years old. Okay. Listen to what she has to say.
Yeah, I was upsold in my gynecologist's office.
You want to hear this story.
No, I really know, but okay.
Kelly told me that she started getting direct mailings from her doctor for cosmetic services, things like teeth whitening and eyelash creams to make your eyelashes longer.
Yep.
Then she goes to the doctor for her exam, and she notices these posters on the wall pushing these services.
Okay.
He's noticed me looking up at the posters and asked if I would be interested in any of those things on the wall. And I just asked him if he thought I needed to be interested in any of the things on the wall. And he just told me it was a personal decision.
Yes.
So, you know, that's a pretty subtle cross sell, right?
Yeah,
and,
you
know, he was making a little money by giving ad space to these cosmetic services. And it reminded me of an experience I had recently where my eye doctor tried to get me to buy an extra pair of glasses just for the computer. And I thought to myself after I left, does he really think I need those?
Yeah, no.
Maybe would that be good for me? Or is he just trying to make
a pair of frames at $140 a whack?
Another sale.
Yeah, yeah.
And Maura Kelly said she felt the same way.
you know, I'm not at the mall and someone's trying to sell me, you know, another pair of shoes. It's that you're in a healthcare situation and you look to them for medical advice and here they are giving it to you, but you have to make that choice as to whether this is, you know, whether you're the patient or whether you're the consumer.
Yeah, and in some ways, ultimately, it's corrosive, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Kelly told me, actually, after that experience, she began to question the medical advice that that doctor was giving her. So this market-driven mindset does have its costs. It's permeated into areas of our lives that, you know, traditionally were off-limits to consumerism and selling. And I like to think of it as sort of a toll we're paying to ride this consumer economy highway.
Yeah.
And so far, Kai, we seem to be willing to pay the toll.
Just say no, baby. Just say no. Sarah Gardner with The Upsell. Sarah, thanks a bunch.
Thanks a lot.
Upselling isn't the only thing companies do to help their profits. There is the more serious issue of laying people off, cutting their hours, or not giving them benefits. Trouble is, that creates a more insecure workforce, which means creating consumers who are also less willing to spend and less able to save. Chad, the guy who tried to upsell me the grill, is one of them.
How long have you been here?
I've actually been here about 2 months.
2 months. Are you working full-time?
I'm part-time.
How many hours?
Just under 30 this last
year. Do you want full-time?
I would love full-time, absolutely.
But
they don't have it.
Are you getting by on 30 hours a week?
I have a second job.
Where do you get health care benefits and all that? Do you get it anywhere?
Not right now, no.
So what do you do?
I don't get sick, and I don't get hurt.
I don't get sick, and I don't get hurt, just in case you didn't hear it over that phone ringing there. There is actually a management phrase for that. It's called efficiency innovation, using part-time workers or fewer workers for just-in-time shifts, as they call them. The industries that are creating the most new jobs in this economy, retail and restaurants, hospitality and healthcare, are also producing the most part-time and temporary jobs, jobs without benefits or any real sense of security, jobs that are in turn creating a different kind of consumer, one without a way to plan for the future. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has this profile.
My name is Vanessa Madrid.
Vanessa Madrid is 43 years old. There's a spring green sculpture above her small kitchen table. It's her art, inspired by ginkgo leaves and the broad butt of one of her friends.
Every time I look at it, it makes me smile. It's a very joyful piece, which I think most of my work is definitely joyful.
Vanessa is a college art teacher. It's part-time work, temporary work. She's an adjunct.
Once you teach at a college, you've made it. Well, on one level, yes, you have, but you may get respect, but you may not get paid.
Universities have gone the way of Walmart, hiring more and more part-timers who are a whole lot cheaper than their tenured colleagues. Today, about 6 in 10 teaching jobs are filled by temporary professors and grad students.
It's about 1:25, 1:20, and we're headed to Riverside City College.
Her job's about an hour and a half from here. Vanessa packs a cooler with her dinner in it. This semester, she's teaching two classes, both basic drawing, 2 days a week. They pay for her rent-controlled apartment, basic bills, a small studio. But that's about it.
Thinking about making any long-term plans, it's really impossible.
She does her laundry at her parents' house. She can't afford to travel.
I would also like to be able to, at some point, move out of my little apartment into a house. And if I keep doing what I'm doing, I will never be able to do that.
When she didn't have enough teaching work, she got a retail job and kept her fingers crossed that none of her students spotted her. Teaching without security has also made a big life decision for her.
Well, at some point I had to think about having kids, and it's not been financially feasible for me to support anybody besides myself.
Vanessa Madrid, or really anyone with part-time temporary work, can't plan, can't act, can't consume with the future in mind. And it's a group that's growing. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, nearly 8 million people who want full-time work have part-time jobs instead. Arnie Kalleberg is a sociology professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of Good Jobs, Bad Jobs, and he says precarious work got its start in the U.S. back in the 70s.
And since then, as employers sought greater flexibility, we have seen increases in temporary work, in contract work, direct hire temps, as well as temp agencies, and even non-temporary work, even regular work, has become more insecure and unstable.
Companies want workers just in time. They want people to work when they need them and only then. I spotted an ad for a part-time job at Lowe's that, quote, requires morning, afternoon, and evening availability any day of the week. And it's happening across the economy. Just in reporting this story, I talked to a phlebotomist who can't afford to live on her own, a shoe salesman who has to upsell customers to earn more hours, a zoo employee whose hours are too low to qualify for health insurance. Some of my colleagues are on contracts.
Labor avoids being a fixed cost and can be shifted around depending on the employer's needs.
But these tenuous jobs rarely meet employee needs.
It creates a lot of uncertainty and insecurity. It may lead to a situation where they don't get health insurance because they don't have enough hours. So it creates a very unstable and uncertain existence.
So charcoal, just like graphite, can be found in different hardness and softnesses.
In the classroom now, Vanessa rubs a nub of charcoal across paper.
Okay, so white hard, what's the softest?
Later, as one class finishes and another group of students shuffles in, she grabs her cooler and ducks outside.
What time did I have lunch? I had lunch about 1 o'clock, a little before. It's now 6, so yeah, I'm getting a little bit low energy, so I got to gear up.
She eats chunks of sweet potato. She tells me a student has just emailed to drop the class. Every semester, kids stop showing up when their work schedules change. Vanessa encourages them to talk to the boss, but a lot of times they're too afraid, or the boss just says, no, we need you when we need you.
Jobs in Riverside are hard to find, so they opt for just dropping sometimes all of their classes.
Students drop out to work at the grocery store or a coffee shop, the kinds of jobs the economy's creating these days.
And some of my students, I found out, are supporting their families with their Starbucks job. So they need to keep working. That's the priority. So it's hard to it's hard to talk a student into staying when they say that.
Goodbye degree, goodbye earning potential that comes with it. A few more bites and Vanessa heads back in.
Hey, you guys left any charcoal on the table?
Another 2.5 hours of class to go.
You guys please check because we
as the last students pack up, Vanessa shoves her stuff into 3 narrow drawers. Adjuncts don't get offices.
It's almost 9:30. So we've been here since, what, 2:40? Yeah.
Now headed home?
Yeah. Now headed home.
It's back to the car and to the hour and a half drive. Vanessa's lined up 2 jobs for this summer, teaching an art class in Riverside and working with kids for the city of Santa Monica. She'll be working 7 days a week.
It's going to be exhausting, but I don't know what's happening in the fall. I'm still looking for another college for the fall. So I have to say yes to everything that comes my way.
A lot of people with part-time work live more precariously than Vanessa. But what they all have in common is the inability to make plans for the future, to build a net, invest. At 43, Vanessa's still hopeful that she'll land that full-time job, doing what she loves, teaching, that she'll get that career, maybe buy a house and have a family.
I really like people. I really like taking care of people. I think I would have been a really great mom, and I think I'll be a really great stepmom someday.
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Here's what we're told to do as consumers. Buy houses to pursue the American dream. Take on debt if we need to. Buy things to help the economy and, at the same time, save for the future. A report not too long ago from one mutual fund company spelled out in plain, bullet-pointed English everything we need to do to retire more comfortably. It's easy. Start saving when you're 25. Save continuously until you're 67. Never get sick, pregnant, or laid off. And, oh yeah, get a raise each and every year. easy comedy pickings right there, people. And Daily Show co-creator Liz Winstead is here to help us with that. Liz, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
So listen, when you were 25, what were you doing? Were you planning for retirement?
I have to tell you, when I was 25, I was planning on trying to maybe not sell plasma to pay off my student loans.
Right. Right. Exactly. Which gets us to the absurdity of this situation, right? They're talking about people having to start at the age of 25 to save for retirement. Come on.
It's Narnia. I think they actually interviewed people who live in Narnia. And when you read the article, they have this hypothetical woman named Lily, mm-hmm. who, you know, never gets sick. She works nonstop. She never gets laid off. I just grew to resent this fake person, Lily, who's never had a hardship in her life. Yeah. But they do base it on such a set of hypotheticals that I don't know one single person has lived.
There's some economic modeling that goes into all this stuff, right? It's you know, your salary increases 1.5% a year. There's inflation at 2.3% a year, all of which is to point out that nobody knows what they're talking about, right? Because a day after tomorrow, you know, J.P. Morgan could go broke again and it'd be all over.
That's exactly right. And so it's all kind of a whole bunch of hocus pocus, smoke and mirrors. And basically what I think the economic model that we all that live in the reality-based community look at is working three jobs. You know, you might retire, but then you're working at one of the fine dignity-saving jobs that you get when you're 70. You know, Walmart greeter, you know, mall Santa, Pope. Mm-hmm. I think those are the big three. This is the new plan. Maybe you retire from 25 to 45. And then you actually work from 45 to 90.
To work.
That's my new plan.
I like that. That's actually pretty good. How do you plan for your retirement? I mean, what do? Do you sock money under your pillow or something?
Well, you know, the good news for us little joke tellers is that we can have arthritis and tell jokes. We can be crippled and tell jokes. You know, we can be sick and tell jokes. I kind of plan on observing the world for as long as I can take breath into my body because I have a feeling as long as people are writing articles like this, I am going to have job security.
Liz Winstead, Air America Radio, The Daily Show. She's got her own book out. It's called Liz Free or Die. Liz,
it gives no financial advice at all.
No financial advice at all. Just like funny stuff. Liz, thanks a bunch.
Thanks.
So the whole plan might seem like a terrible idea at this point, but who came up with the 401k in the first place? Marketplace's Scott Tong looked into how retirement became a do-it-yourself thing.
Introducing the father of the 401k. Ted Benna is a decidedly un-Wall Street kind of guy. He grew up on a Pennsylvania dairy farm.
My dad did a great thing for me there. I had my own cow when I was 7 years old, and we got paid a little money from that.
Hard work and thrift is Ted Benna's answer to a world full of stuff to buy. He spent his career planning people's retirements, so I figure, hey, I'll show him my 401k, get some free advice.
Yes, it appears you get a dollar-for-dollar match. Does that sound right? Well, that's super.
A bit of small talk yields quickly to a lecture. It turns out I'm drowning in fees.
You are in investments that are more expensive.
You're talking about the fees.
That you don't see.
Benna has one main beef with the system. It's too complicated.
Well, when you have one, two, three, four, five.
In my case, he says 20 investment choices is too many. But wait, this is the father of the 401k.
Hey, I'd blow up the existing structure and start over.
What's he mean? Well, to understand, let's back up to the accidental rise of the 401k. Let's go back to the 60s and 70s. Back then, if you worked for a big company and you retired, you got a pension, a regular check. Benna helped to run these plans. He was a consultant. And in the late 70s, he was unhappy.
Most of what I was doing was working with business owners. Their main interest was, how can I get the biggest tax break and give the least to my employees legally?
Then Benna says inspiration came from two very different places. God, he's a religious man, and the Internal Revenue Code. It was 1978. Congress passed an obscure add-on to Tax Code Section 401.
I added this little paragraph K, and I still have, you know, original copy. It was about a page and a quarter long. That's all it was.
401k was an unassuming tax break for companies letting workers put away some cash on the side. Only the tax nerds noticed. Until divine inspiration hit Benna.
Well, how about adding a match? an additional incentive. Immediately, I jumped to, wow, this is a big deal.
His concoction was effectively a bribe for workers. They got extra money from the boss and a tax break if they took some of their own paycheck and set it aside for retirement.
The biggest benefit of 401k is it converts them from spenders to savers. It enables them to do something they wouldn't do on their own.
Bennett had a hunch that 401ks would take off. Indeed, they did in the early 80s. Big companies offered him first, and in the meantime, they started to ditch their pension plans, which were expensive. And before long,
401k became very popular for little companies to have that never had any retirement program.
Thus began the era of make-your-own retirement. The American worker now faced a choice: spend my whole paycheck, or take the employer match slash bribe and start to save. It made for some tension.
Now you go home to your spouse, and she says, are you nuts? I mean, look, the end of the month, we got nothing left. I mean, how are you going to put 6% of your pay in? But you say, well, look, my company's going to give me 3%. I'm crazy if I don't do this.
By the mid-90s, 30 million Americans had 401k plans. Do-it-yourself retirement seemed easy in the decade's bull market. We know what came next in 2000. That's when the dot-com bubble burst. Then, in the financial crisis, the average 401k plan lost 27%.
Unfortunately, the worst thing that happened with this wretched market is too many people had the highest stock ownership that they ever had at the wrong time.
Today, the typical middle-class household nearing retirement has saved $120,000. That's about one-tenth what many say it needs. And for all the 401k growth, about half of all workers still have no plan. Has the system failed us? I asked Ted Bennett that today. He's thought a lot about that. It's almost like his creation got overtaken by events. He never meant for the explosion and all the confusing investment choices. The original plans offered two. It was never Ted Bennett's idea for do-it-yourself to replace pensions. It just kind of happened.
This is kind of the whole enchilada, you know.
What's your thought on it now having become the whole enchilada?
Well, it's not good, but it's reality.
Bennett says the 401k was never meant to take care of everyone. It was simply a financial product that took off. And it did help middle-income Americans, tens of millions of them.
What makes the U.S. different and has historically is a strong middle class. Doesn't matter what your society is, you're always going to have your top and you're going to have plenty on the bottom, unfortunately. The key is what is going to be in the middle and what financial condition are they going to be in.
And if the 401k has done anything, creator Ted Bennett argues it's forced a whole lot of thrift into household economics. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A whole lot of us have trouble putting aside money for the future, but it turns out that's often been the case in the history of this country. The most recent housing crisis wasn't the only time that we bought things we couldn't afford and hoped things would work out for the best. Part of this consumer economy is about uncertainty, and part of that was the financial crisis 5 years ago when lots of us discovered our booming consumer economy was, in fact, a bubble. And one thing about a bubble is that few people recognize it. They're running ahead, keeping up, investing in what they think makes logical sense, and then wham. Like most of history, that's happened before. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner went to the high plains of Montana to report on a little-known bubble from a century ago with a couple of eerie parallels to our own time.
Finally, they came to a rich, fertile valley. And with deep thanks and prayer for their safety, they began their new life.
Okay. Cut the schmaltz. This isn't that kind of pioneer story. This one you might call the homestead swindle. It's got scheming corporations, greedy bankers, and wide-eyed American dreamers. All the characters in this story are dead now, but a few of their voices are preserved on tape.
When I came out, the train was loaded with people coming to Homestead. People were just going crazy. It was just like a gold rush, I suppose.
That was pioneer Lillian Stevenson. A museum in Billings, Montana, interviewed her a few decades back. because Lillian, well, she was part of one of the most dramatic and contrived real estate booms in American history. You see, she and over 80,000 others swarmed to Montana in the 1910s. The bait? Well, it was sort of like the early 20th century version of a zero-down mortgage. It was free land, 320 acres under the Homestead Act. And to a lot of folks back then, that offer sounded like a no-brainer.
Especially Scandinavians, Germans coming from Europe with absolutely nothing and seeing an opportunity to establish themselves out west on what for them must have seemed like a kingdom.
Derek Strawn, he's a historic preservationist in Bozeman. Strawn says railroad tycoons like the Great Northern's James Hill, they lobbied Congress like today's K Street pros to get the homestead law expanded.
They were desperate to get people settling here so that they could capitalize on freight rates and that sort of thing.
300 acres on three conditions: build a house, grow some crops, and stay for at least 3 years. The railroads would subsidize your train fare to Montana. Heck, they'd even sell you some of their land for cheap. And the banks, oh, they were more than happy to lend you lots of money, even if you were dirt poor or didn't know a tractor from a tin can.
To have major corporations and to have the U.S. government saying, we want you to do this, we will provide incentives that make it possible for you. People listened to that and they thought to themselves, how can we go wrong?
Sounds scarily familiar? What followed was irrational exuberance, nearly a century before Alan Greenspan coined the term. And just like during our housing bubble, there were good reasons to feel exuberant. For one, there'd been plenty of rain. Montana wheat was winning top prize at national competitions, and farmers were getting top price for it. Billings historian Kevin Koistra.
All of these things are kicking in and lending itself to that sense of optimism.
Outright propaganda fueled the boom, too.
This has always been a droughty country. The railroad put out a lot of false information about, oh, man, it was just great out here.
Dale Brown is retired in the tiny town of Terry, Montana, but his family still owns and ranches on his grandpa's homestead, about a half hour outside Terry.
The wind is nasty.
Trees are in short supply here. It's all buttes and broad rolling grasslands.
Up on the hill right through that gate is where grandpa's first house was. And then over there you can see that silver pipe sticking up out of the ground. That was their first water well.
Brown's heard all the stories, how the railroads hired the madmen of their day to help lure people here, the advertising that made Montana look like lush English countryside.
There was one difference between eastern Montana and the desert in Arizona, one snowstorm.
In fact, 320 acres of this second-rate soil, it wasn't nearly enough to make a living. But Dale's grandpa lived in a time of what now sound like superstitious beliefs, like the idea that the mere act of farming the land would bring more rain. Sort of like the belief, just a few years ago, that housing prices will always go up. And both of those myths attracted speculators. David Wishart, a Great Plains geographer, says forget Little House on the Prairie. Many of the Montana homesteaders weren't looking to stay.
The idea was land values will go up as schools and roads and county courthouses go in, and we will then sell at a profit and move on elsewhere. It was all a process of capitalizing on cheap land.
But just like housing prices fell in 2008, the rains here stopped. World War I ended and grain prices fell. Drought set back in and stuck. Farms started foreclosing, banks went belly up. By the middle of the 1920s, over 90% of those wide-eyed dreamers were gone, and they left with no assets, no nest egg, no nothing. Some ended up clinging to the sides of the train, desperate to flee Montana. Pioneer Lillian Stevenson, the one on tape, she told her interviewer the only reason she didn't skip town and go back to her native Missouri.
I didn't have the money to buy a ticket.
Otherwise, you'd have gone back.
I'd have went back. If I'd have had the money to buy a ticket, I'd have been gone, same as the others. I'd have gone.
If you ask people in Montana now, they'll tell you the whole homesteading scheme had a snowflake's chance in hell of succeeding. This droughty part of the country could never have supported all those homesteaders the railroads enticed here. Of course, that's the same kind of thing we all say today, in hindsight, about the housing market crash. In eastern Montana, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
So, where does this all leave us? We owe you an answer, we think, to our question that we've been posing this week. Can we afford our consumer economy? The answer is yes, but. The but is that there are costs to living and spending and consuming as we do. Marketplace's Adrian Hill and David Weinberg get us into them.
Since the dawn of man, we've basically always wanted more.
We're going to introduce you. So we've got two cavemen. There's Ig.
And Ook.
And Ook. And Ig, it turns out, is a super great hunter-gatherer.
Yeah, his cave is full of stuff.
There's meat everywhere.
Yeah. Ook?
No.
No, not so
He's
much.
He's kind of, you know, he just didn't gather as much as Ig. He kind of loafed.
Yeah, good. Very good.
And here's what happens. You know how this is going to go. Ig lived. Ig had a ton to eat.
Oh!
Ook, he did not survive the winter.
He died. And so all of us, we're likely the descendants of Ig. At least that's what scientists think. We're descendants of the caveman who was really good at getting all that caveman stuff.
And you can see that today in that we have this internal desire for more.
The ancient philosophers knew of insatiability. You know, the myth of Midas, the man who wants to turn everything into gold, that's clearly about insatiability.
So that's Edward Skidelsky. He's the author of a book, How Much is Enough?
And that insatiability that he was talking about, another way to think about it is that's our inner Ig.
But this inner Ig is all amped up, Skidelsky says.
It's on steroids.
What's happened under capitalism is that the old restraints on insatiability have all been lifted, the old moral restraints. So capitalism inflames insatiability through advertising, through marketing, this endless kindling of new needs.
But there's something else that drives us, and that's each other. Like, I'm driven by my neighbor. David, I'm driven by you, by everyone around me.
So you want things not because you need them in any absolute sense, but because other people have them or other people don't have them.
And we see this in the rise of McMansions, in SAT tutors. But we also see this everywhere in life.
And we wanted to know, what are the costs of all this buying and lusting for more? So we flew to Boston to talk to Harvard professor Michael Sandel. He wrote a book called What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. And it's all about how we've gone from having a market economy to being a market society where everything is for sale. And on our way, we decided to take advantage of the way that the market works, of what you can buy when everything is for sale. Take, for example, something that's familiar to all of us. Cutting lines.
Yeah, we wanted to have two different experiences at the airport. So David got to buy all the upgrades, and I flew on a regular old ticket. The first big difference was the security line.
David's just skipped this entire line.
It wasn't a velvet rope, but it was a rope that was opened up for me. I breezed through security. Meanwhile,
I watched David breeze through security as I twisted around in a snaking queue and tried to wave at David.
But I couldn't see her. I was already through security. And while she was twisting through that line, I was done. So I went and I ordered some coffee.
Can I get a double espresso and a tall Americano?
He bought me coffee, which was sweet because then he went to his fancy lounge.
Right. So then I got to go into the Premier Club, which was like this very nice room with wood panel walls and dark lighting and free food. It was kind of like the lobby of a hotel.
And I took my coffee to a gate that was so packed with people I couldn't sit down. So once we got to Boston, we asked Sandel what he thought about all of this.
And he says that buying a better seat or paying to board the plane earlier, like I did, there's nothing wrong with that.
That's a convenience. That's a service that the airlines should be free to sell.
But
what about quicker access to the security line?
Sandel says that's the real problem.
Because that, after all, is not a service. That's not a consumer service exactly. That line, the security check, is for the sake of the common good. It's really for the sake of of the security of everyone flying, and for that matter, it's for the sake of national security. And so maybe there is a stronger civic case against letting money decide David's quicker access to the security line.
This is just one example, and it's not a big one. It's one most of us are familiar with, of the way we live in a market society.
Take another example, America's favorite pastime, baseball. This is a great place to see the market at work.
Mr. Red Sox, pinning with it. Get today's program. $3. $3.
$2 programs. Get him right here. Get him right here.
And so that's exactly what we did. We took Sandell to a Red Sox game.
He points out all sorts of ways money has changed the game. And one of them is the way corporate sponsorship has worked its way into the very language of baseball.
When a player slides safely into a base, there's a promotion now with an insurance company, New York Life, where the announcer has to say, safe at home, safe and secure, New York Life.
And at first, these kinds of things are just irritating.
But the accumulated effect is that even the very language of the game, which has historically had a kind of lyrical quality with the best announcers, now the lyrical quality of the broadcast is diminished.
Well, what do we lose when that happens?
What we lose is a kind of direct, unfiltered relationship to the game, to the sounds of the game, to the rhythm of it. And it becomes yet one more part of life that's invaded and dominated by commercial values.
He says we've lost a relationship to something else, too. Basically, to each other. One of the consequences of living in a market society, says Sandell, is that we just don't hang out with each other the way we used to.
It's what Sandell calls the skyboxification of American life. And to tell the story, we actually snuck into a luxury skybox at Fenway Park.
With a Harvard professor. We snuck in.
We have a great perch behind glass. It's air-conditioned in here. If the rain starts up again, we won't get wet.
We did this for a very specific reason. Sandell worries that the wealthy in our modern society can lead very separate lives.
It's no longer true that everyone stands in the same long lines for the restroom. No longer the case that everyone eats the same pretty inadequate food. And it's no longer true that when it rains, everyone gets wet.
This wouldn't really matter all that much if we were just talking about baseball games and airports. But Sandell says when you add up all these examples, plus things like access to better healthcare and education, it creates a problem for us.
Democracy doesn't require perfect equality, but it does require that men and women from different backgrounds, different walks of life, encounter one another, bump up against one another in the ordinary course of life. Because this is what gives us a sense that we are all in this together. It gives us a sense of being engaged in a common project. And without that background experience of a shared civic life, it's very difficult to think and act as democratic citizens.
Sandell thinks we should at least talk about these choices.
How we decide what and how much to consume.
And whether we should even have these choices.
Because even if we can sustain this consumption in the short run, it's not without costs. I'm Adrian Hill.
I'm David Weinberg.
For Marketplace.
There you have it, the consumer economy. Parents, workers, CEOs, borrowers, debtors, and cavemen, too. There is even more from the series. You can play a game or two as well and tell us what you think of it at marketplace.org.